bonjour and bienvenue to Battle Royale, where we are passing judgment on all the kings and emperors of France from Clovis to Napoleon III.
Who will be selected as the creme de la creme and who will be sent to the guillotine?
Je m'appelle Ben Clark.
And I'm Eliza Summers. And welcome back for part two.
My mouth feels really stuck together today. I'm just like...
Does it not taste good?
I've got a mouth ulcer, so then maybe that's not...
maybe that's why.
I also just woke up, so not something that we should talk about on the podcast.
Probably related, though, to... I'm sure a lot of royalty had to deal with ulcers, so...
At least I'm not dying of gout, which is what Louis XII died of. Now, Eliza, before we get into rating Louis XII, which is what we are currently here to do, would you like to give us a little recap of his life?
So he was born, obviously.
Shocker.
Yeah, shocker. And so he grew up as like a prince of the realm, and but the Spider King was like, ugh, you peed on me, so I'm going to hate you for life. When he's a baby, of course. And so then because of that...
Yeah, at the baptism.
The Spider King's like, I'm just going to make your life as difficult as possible. I'm going to make you marry my daughter, who even in my eyes is grotesque and disfigured. And Louis's like, I don't want to. But he was forced to have this marriage, and he even cried at the banquet afterwards. Even though I don't think Joan was that happy to be married to him either, but I wouldn't be. So then that happens, and then eventually Spider King dies, and along comes his cousin, who's the Spider King's son, Louis XII.
Oh, you mean Charles VIII.
Oh, yeah, sorry, Charles VIII, you know. The king, Spider King died, and then Charles came to power, but Charles wasn't really in power because he was so young. So then Anne was like a bombastic regent, but she and Louis were like, I don't like you. We don't like each other. And Louis was like, fine, I'm going to become regent. And Anne's like, no, you don't. I'm going to lock you up instead after you try to create a little civil war thing going on. And so Louis's in prison for a while. I think it was what, 3 years. But prison wasn't really prison. It was like a nice castle. So, yeah. And so then when Charles grew up and came into his own, he's like, I'll set you free, cousin, because I really admire you. And Louis's like, thanks, bro. So then they're like little besties. And then they go and do the first Italian campaign together. But in the end, that was just a disaster, especially as Louis got sick and he's like, but then he healed, but la da da da, they went back to France. But then his cousin died and he's like, oh my God, I am now the king. It only makes sense that I marry my cousin's wife. So he's like, and she's like, I'll give you a year to get annul your marriage to Joan. And if you don't make it within a year, then no love for you. And Louis's like, don't worry, Pope's got my back. So Pope's like, yeah, I do. And with a sign and a swish, he's like, my marriage with Joan annulled. Now I can marry you. So then he goes, hot skim to jump. And they seem to have a really good marriage for most part until it came deciding their daughter's marriage, which then was like a whole other deal.
This is with Anne of Brittany.
Yeah,
by the
Anne of Brittany.
Yeah. You didn't mention her name.
Sorry. And then Louis's like, I really want to be the Duke of Milan. I deserve it. It's in my right. So second Italian campaign, let's go. And at first it was like really, really good. And they're like connected with Venice. And they're like, boom, we've got this. Boom, 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 boom. We've done it. And then Louis's like, okay, I'm going to go off now. But then while he's off, all the other powers are like, oh my God, Venice is looking a bit sus there. They're getting too much power for our likings. And Louis's like, I'll join with you. Let's take down Venice. But then before they could even really take down Venice, they were like squabbling amongst each other, being like, I want this land, la, 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 la. And then the new Pope, because, or was this, was the Borgia one? Yeah, he died by then.
No, Borgia Pope's dead. This is Julius II.
And he's like, I don't like you, France, anymore. So, bye-bye, I'm not going to help you. Screw you, you don't deserve Milan. And Louis's like, what the hell? And Pope's like, I've got all the other Catholic countries behind me, and they don't like you, so go away, get out. And basically he got kicked out of Milan. Was it after he came back, he had the feud with his wife?
No, he'd already had the feud with his wife by this point.
Prior to that, he'd had a feud with his wife, and she's like, F you, I'm going to go back home and stay for 5 years. No love for you.
Yeah.
But then they eventually reconcile 5 years later, and then
she dies old. Shortly after that.
Oh, yeah. Then she dies, and then shortly after that, he dies.
He dies, yeah. Although, before he dies...
His daughter gets married.
No, he has another wife.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. He got Margaret Tudor. So he's like, oh, England and Mary Tudor, sorry. Mary Margaret, whatever. And they're like, oh, we're friends, England and France. Let's have a marriage alliance. And then their marriage was like, you know, only a few weeks in. And then he's having too much fun in the bed and died.
Yes.
Allegedly.
Well, it was gout, but the minstrels
chronicles
had a lot
at
of
the
fun
time were all like with nah with
his death, yeah. So
and now she's a widow.
That was pretty good. That was a good recap.
I know it was a good recap. I did get a bit muddled with the times, but you know, who can blame me?
That's all right. We've had like three episodes going over the same series of events, more or less.
They all sort of blend together.
So, yeah, all sort of
merged
together.
And I forget the order.
But yeah, listen to last episode again if you want to sort out that chronology. But now we're now going to go into rating Louis. We're going to be out of chronological order. We're going to just give a holistic view of mainly just his reign. But first, we've got to look at this man and judge how he looks.
Yes, let's
have a
look.
So we're getting into Enchanté.
Enchanté.
And I'm going to send you the most often used portrait of Louis XII, first of all.
Okay.
The most basic one, I guess. It's actually painted the year of his death. It's called the Windsor Portrait, as it was originally hung in Windsor Castle. It's now in Hampton Court Palace. And it was brought to England by the guy who painted it, Jean Perial, who was sent to show it to Henry VIII and Mary Tudor in
1514. It was like the marriage portrait, prospective.
Yeah. And then Perial, in turn, produced a portrait of Mary Tudor to bring home to Louis XII.
Yeah, I can't really say much. It's just like, meh.
He's got a cool, very Tudor-y hat. It looks a lot like the portraits you see of, like, Richard III and, like, Henry Tudor. It's like, it's that same sort of style, the early 16th century style. Well, he's better looking than Charles VIII, I'll say that.
Yeah. He's got blue eyes.
He does have blue eyes. Yeah. Blue for France. I've also got an earlier devotional portrait by Jean Bourdichon, which is corresponding to the portrait of Anne of Brittany that we used.
Okay.
So this is the one of Louis, which is kind of like a different page of the manuscript. And as with Anne, he's surrounded by sort of patron saints that kind of represent him.
Is he in armor?
He's in armor.
Oh.
He'll be in armor quite a bit, actually.
Well, that's good. They're keeping it true. Love the armor.
And behind him, he's got the Archangel Michael. He's got Charlemagne with the big beard. He's got Saint Louis with the fleur-de-lis.
Saint Denis.
And he's got Saint Denis. Yeah. Or Saint Denis. Saint Denis the Menace.
I love how his helmet's on the ground and it's like the traditional, like, you know, full head helmet. Like you'd see back in medieval days, but for crown on top. Finally, a crown. I've missed you.
It is very nice. And he's got the full, you know, 15th century armor as well.
Yeah.
I love that his scabbard even has fleur-de-lis on it.
He does. That's really I know. Cool. He looks much better looking.
Yeah. But he's still got this weird sort of mullety thing.
Yeah. Ugh.
He's got a haircut like...
I hate mullets.
The kids from Stranger Things.
You mean a bowl cut?
I called it Stranger Kings.
That should be a series.
Stranger Kings, that's the look.
That should be a title of a book about, like, strange rulers and power throughout history.
Stranger Kings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're copywriting that, taking that, no one can steal idea.
Yeah. I also have another depiction of Louis and Anne together, which is actually their tomb, which is this beautiful Italian sculpture by Giovanni Giusti. It was finished in 1531, so a bit after his death, but it is, of course, his tomb.
Ooh. Nice.
And this is in the Basilica of Saint-Denis, of course.
I love how they've got, like, it's a church, and then they're like, oh, let's have these women without clothes covering their breasts.
Well, they're not real women. They're,
I know, sort of, but still.
Allegories of virtue, I guess.
You think virtue for the church would mean covering up.
It's the Italian Renaissance.
True, well, true.
You can't have the Italian Renaissance without naked women.
I know, it's great. No, I'm just like, it's kind of like, you know, when you think of the church and stuff, you think all like covered up. So then it's funny to see that in a church, the irony of it all.
This tomb effigy is really interesting and really different from any of the other ones we get. So at the top, you've got Louis and Anne sort of praying, very sort of basic conventional kind of thing.
Yeah.
And this is supposed to be them in life. But then below them, you have them in death.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah, I thought that was interesting. It's like double.
Underneath these sort of archways, and this sort of Roman column kind of structure,
I do like that idea,
which is surrounded by all of these statues of saints and allegories.
Yeah,
you've got the two of them lying down, and it's actually it's got them in their sort of embalmed dead state. I'll show you like a close up picture of it
of the embalmed body.
Yeah, cool. Both of them.
They look like Egyptian mummies.
Well. If you unwrapped an Egyptian mummy, yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Wow, you can see the ribs.
This will all be on the WordPress site. I found it quite almost shocking to see this.
Okay, he looks like he's sleeping, like the little smile, and she clearly looks like she's dead.
Well, she's been dead for longer.
Not that much longer.
A year longer. But you can see that they're like naked as well. They're unclothed.
What's covering
and she's
them?
Holding this little cloth over her sensitive area.
So what are they embalmed in?
They're embalmed in the way that like you embalm like a dead body to be displayed.
Oh.
So like the way we do it now, basically, where you kind of put like stuffing and stuff in the body and just sort of put it there.
I mean, so like a taxidermy. Like
well, you know how they embalm bodies today so that they can have like open casket funerals.
But I've never seen that in real life.
It's not a very common practice where we grew up, but it is in some places.
Yeah.
I don't know what methods actually they use to embalm bodies. That's a good
question
that I can't be bothered to research. So, so the tomb, by having this kind of double depiction, it functions as a kind of memento mori, kind of reminder of, you know, the fact that everyone will dies, die. Everyone rots, decomposes, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's also a symbol of the resurrection of all bodies and souls, which will occur on Judgment Day. And, you know, Louis and Anne being virtuous, perfect,
they'll be fine.
Never did anything wrong rulers, they will be intact and beautiful when that day comes.
Yay for them.
So yeah, I think this is probably the most sort of profound and kind of meaningful artwork we've had in relation to a king. It's between this and Anne's heart reliquary thing.
It looks like they look like marble. They look like their bodies.
Yeah, no, the whole thing is made of marble.
No, like their actual body.
Yeah, it's all marble.
The dead
no, this
body.
Is not their actual body. This is
I was thinking that was weird. Depiction. I was thinking, what the hell? Why do they look real? Or like look like marble?
Because he's a good sculptor.
Yeah.
No, they're
but
not
they're
real. This is actually marble.
Underneath it.
Yeah, no, these are not the dead bodies.
Good. I was going, these marble. Are weird dead bodies.
No, it's marble. I can't believe we went through that whole thing with you thinking it was actually their dead bodies.
Well, I was thinking, they're not their dead bodies, but the way he's saying it makes it seem like it is. But I was going, no, it's not.
No, I'm talking about the sculpture. But you have to agree, it's interesting and different for this to be sculpted. Like, we haven't seen a sculpture like this.
Yeah, sculpting someone's death.
Yeah, but I just find it's interesting. Mm-hmm. Especially since Louis commissioned this and this was kind of Louis's intention for his tomb.
Yeah.
It's not the real tomb. So, architecture in France. Moving on to architecture.
Yes. What did he build?
It remained pretty, like, traditional and Gothic. It was kind of reflective of the Milanese style. Milan kind of still did this kind of, like, flamboyant Gothic style.
Yeah.
Even when places like Florence had moved on to, like, a more Romany style.
Yeah.
But, you know, the other Italian influences also creeping in, particularly in sculpture, as we've seen.
Yes.
And when he and Anne redesigned their chateau at Blois, Louis had an equestrian statue of himself embedded onto one of the walls, which is designed by the Modenese sculptor Guido Mazzoni.
Okay.
And I'll show you this. It's like a life-sized equestrian statue, which is above one of the doors.
Nice.
That's quite magnificent.
Oh, and it's got a horsey.
The horse is the star of the show, really.
Yeah, it really is. Screw the king. There's a horse.
But Louis looks very real and magnificent, and you can always spot him with his mullet.
It's not a mullet. It's a bowl cut.
It's kind of like somewhere in between, I think.
It's not a mullet. Because
it is actually longer in the back. If you look at the portrait kind of side on, it kind of starts like a bowl cut in the front, and then it comes down to become a mullet in the back. Apologies to any listeners with mullets.
Yeah, sorry. It's just not my cup of tea.
They are weirdly fashionable now, though.
I know. Even in Japan, I've started seeing the mullets on the kids.
So speaking of Italian artists, once again. Yeah. So while in Italy, Louis also became familiar with the work of one Leonardo da Vinci.
Cool beans.
Yeah. He was variously working in like Florence and Rome and Milan. So Louis was familiar with him. Demand. And he was not only an artist, but also a scientist and a military engineer, which is why he was in high demand during the Italian Wars. And Louis tried to convince Leonardo to come to France to work for him. But Leonardo delayed because of a lawsuit that he was fighting in Florence. Ooh. And he didn't end up coming to France until after Louis' death.
Oh.
So he's more known as being,
Yeah.
Yeah, and his relationship with King Francis I. But it's actually Louis who first invited him over. Oh. So, fun fact. And brought the Mona Lisa with him.
Nice.
So, now let's get into propaganda.
Yes. Oh, does he have an epithet?
He does have an epithet, and which is connected to his propaganda.
Okay.
His epithet is Père du Peuple, or Father of the People.
When you said that, I was thinking immediately ahead, I was like going, is he going to say Father of the Père?
No. Père means father.
Yeah. The Père of the People!
Yeah. His modern biographer, Frederick Baumgartner, tells us that, quote, for no king prior to Louis XIV was so strong an effort made to present the king in so favourable a light.
Hmm.
Which is high praise.
Yeah.
Louis sponsored popular writers and pamphleteers to promote his image. This image of this king who not only won glorious victories in war, but also had a gentle, chivalrous heart and was always looking out for the little guy. And Louis used the printing press to great effect in disseminating his image.
Nice.
Yeah. The new printing press. It has been around for a while, but it's only now that
becoming popular.
Start to take note of it. So both in his pamphlets and in the architecture of his chateau, Louis made his royal badge an iconic signature of his reign. Ooh. So we saw this with Anne of Brittany using the cordelier, the knotted cord, as her symbol. And badges like this, like personal badges, have always existed, but they start to become more of a major part of the public image.
Maybe one of our listeners will design me one. That way I can see what they would think is.
Would it be a jellyfish?
Yeah, probably.
Could be a jellyfish.
Or a potato. I do love potatoes, literally. Anytime I get drunk, I just talk about how great potatoes are.
What does the potato represent?
It represents the most diverse of food, such as me, who I am very diverse in terms of my weirdness.
Yeah, you never know what you're going to get with Eliza. She's
very
diverse.
I'm like a potato, diverse.
Great.
Yeah.
So Louis's badge was the porcupine.
Because he was prickly.
Well, so the porcupine, it's a gentle herbivore. It will do you no harm unless you try to harm it. Yeah. And that was his whole idea. It was also believed at the time that porcupines could shoot their spines at people.
Cool. I wish they did.
And this inspired Louis's motto, Cominus et Aminus, which means from near and from far.
I will shoot you.
So he's like, I'll get you.
I'll spike you down.
And I've got a picture of one of his porcupines. These are like all over the place in his chateaus. There's even porcupines on his cannons as well.
I kind of always forget there's porcupines in Europe.
Yeah, they live in Europe.
I wonder if anyone ever ate porcupines.
Oh, they ate everything.
They ate pigeon.
So another animal that can be found in Louis's symbolism is the viper, which is on his coat of arms. This being the viper of Milan, the symbol of the Visconti family, because Louis believes himself to be the rightful heir. And this viper on the Milan coat of arms is like a viper eating a man.
Nice. Well, if you're going to depict a viper, may as well show it eating something.
Show it eating a man.
Yeah.
At first you think it's the viper's like tongue, but then you look closer and it's like, oh, that's a man.
Why do you think it's a tongue? It's huge. It's, you know, it looks more like a dragon than a viper.
Yeah, they weren't amazing at animal anatomy back then. You got the dolphins that look like weird sea monsters as well.
Yeah. Or the horses can be pretty creepy sometimes.
Another secondary symbol of Louis XII was the beehive as well. So bees come up every now and then.
I remember the bees! Monarchy,
as we know, the bees, golden bees from the Merovingian period.
Yes.
Bees also come up again with the with Napoleon as well. Nice. And you can see Louis using the bees in a stunning painting of him leading troops out of the city of Alessandria during his Italian campaign. This is when he's about to go to Genoa and they like surrender with all of their virgins. With the palm fronds and they're like, please don't kill us.
They're like, that's just enough virgins to appease me.
Exactly. This is the same painter as before, Jean Bourdichon, and it's from Le Voyage de Gênes, which is like the travel to Genoa.
Hmm. Oh my god, his helmet hat. Oh,
his helmet has this massive feathery plume.
It looks
well.
Like ostrich like plume. That's how big it
is. They would be ostrich, yeah. Very.
And the others get multicolored plumes.
Yeah. And then his surcoat and his horse's coat thing
looks
covered in bees with a beehive in the middle.
I like that. I like it a lot.
If you look at like the hem, there's a motto that's written.
Latin.
Which is non utiter aculeo rex qui paremur, which means the king whom we obey does not use his sting.
Nice.
So it's like, it's the kind of the same thing as the porcupine where it's like,
I'm
a gentle king, but if you provoke me, I will come
sting
and slaughter your family.
Make you regret being alive.
At this point, there was also, similar to the porcupine shooting its spikes, there was a misunderstanding of bees, and it was thought that there was a king bee rather than a queen bee. So the queen bee originally was thought to be male.
Of course. Because
guess
who's, like a woman,
guess who's writing all the science books? It's men.
Even though the ones who are really in charge are the worker bees, because when if the queen starts becoming useful, they will kill her.
They just kill her.
Yeah, and they find a new queen.
But the worker bees are male and female.
When it comes to winter, they kick out the male bees and let them die. They're like, you're useless. It is great.
So it is still a matriarchy at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So that's Louis the 12th's sort of main depictions. He cuts quite the figure, I think.
Yeah, I do like seeing some warriors again.
There aren't a lot of modern depictions to speak of. If listeners find any, let me know. He's in the TV series Borgia, not to be confused with The Borgias, which is the one that we've actually seen. Have you seen both of them?
No, I don't think so.
No, I've only seen The Borgias.
Yeah,
but this is Borgia. And there's a plot line from season one of The Tudors. That is kind of about him, but it's not him. Where, you know, Henry VIII has his sister sent to marry the king of Portugal.
Oh, yeah.
He's kind of like a stand-in for Louis the 12th. She's called Margaret in that, not Mary, which makes it confusing.
Yeah.
And she basically murders him before screwing Charles Brandon on a boat.
Yes.
But we'll get to the real story of Mary Tudor this episode. That's Enjeune Day for Louis. That's all his depictions. What would we like to rate him?
I like having some warrior depictions. I think it's quite good. Like, I like seeing that battliness. We haven't had that I've liked as much. I'm thinking like 7.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just need a... I don't know. It's like, it's good, but there's like not that oomph.
It's very good. I mean, if he'd have had this level of stuff like 100 years ago, it would have been like really, really high.
But
we're raising our standards
now.
there's going to be more surviving things for everyone.
Yeah.
So I think it's good that we sort of set the bar kind of high from this point. So I think I'd agree with a 7.
Cool.
In that it's not overwhelmingly fabulous, but it is good. And he doesn't have the same sort of lasting reputation that...
like his English counterpart.
Or like his, Francis
I. He does really not he's have very a much, good reputation, though.
He's very much overshadowed by Francis I as well.
Yeah.
I will try not to compare the French king's reputations to the English king's, because we are biased because we were brought up learning about the English
kings. And it's not like we can't compare him even, because like if you think about it, he was surrounded by a lot of interesting rulers like Ferdinand.
Yeah, if we were Spanish, we would be talking about how he's not as important as Ferdinand.
Yeah.
That's a 14 for Enchanté, because I agree with the score. So moving on to En Garde.
En Garde.
Throughout most of his life, Louis was considered a very active and virile prince and then king.
Mm-hmm.
Something which provoked the envy of Louis the 11th and then the admiration of Charles the 8th. So he was always considered to be a promising heir.
Yeah.
He was always noted as being an excellent sportsman, whether that be in tennis, hunting, or jousting. When Louis became king, he stepped away from jousting as he considered it too dangerous for a king to participate in. Which is something that future kings will be slow to learn. But Louis knew it from the outset. He's like, this sport, too dangerous for kings. But well into old age, he continued hunting, and he was often accompanied by his daughter Claude.
Huh.
And all of this was despite a number of severe, unspecified illnesses Louis suffered, which could render him bedridden for months.
Oh.
But when he was not suffering for those, he was pretty, he seemed pretty active. Healthy. So despite Louis' ultimate defeat in Milan and Naples, his gains in Italy were nothing to scoff at. He's at least laid the groundwork. And when he is the Duke of Milan, he's extended the borders of France and its vassals further than they had been since the first Louis the Pious, nice. Which is quite a feat. And because Louis had done the work to properly plan his invasion, set up his network of Italian alliances, he was able to accomplish most of this within about 6 months.
How long it took
for him to conquer Milan.
Wow,
that's
super quick.
According to Machiavelli, though, Louis' mistake was that rather than capitalize on his success and push his power further into Italy, making the Pope and Venice his vassals, instead he decided to support the Papal States and help them gain territory in the Romagna, which ended in disaster when the Pope... Pope Alexander died.
Oh yeah, not Pope.
And then Pope Julius turned on him later on.
Yeah.
And betrayed him. So what Louis should have done, in Machiavelli's opinion, was side with lesser states like Caterina Sforza's in Romagna against the growing might of the Pope in Venice. So basically preventing any one state in Italy from gaining enough power to challenge him.
Yeah.
Yeah, divide and conquer, nice. I suppose, is what Machiavelli is saying, which Louis does not do. He very much is too nice to his allies, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Or he's making allies with the wrong people.
Yeah. Backstabbers.
Yeah, but that's according to Machiavelli, who is a very harsh critic of Louis. So despite being a bit smarter, particularly when it came to meddling in Italian politics, Louis' war effort had the exact same problem that Charles VIII had. His troops were too poorly disciplined. They got away with the kind of murder, assault, and robbery that they would never have gotten away with in France. And this did not endear the French occupiers to their Italian subjects.
Yeah.
So Machiavelli, yet again, is the one to point this out. He remarks that those who had enthusiastically rejected Sforza rule... when Louis came in, they were like, oh, the new rulers, this is going to be different. They realized that things were even worse under French rule, and then they came to regret their decision. And then that's why Ludovico Sforza's son, Massimiliano Sforza, who's now the Duke of Milan, despite being a rather inept teenager, was able to sort of swoop in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Mulan was taken back almost as quickly as... he held it for, like, quite a few years, actually.
Yeah.
But then it was taken ultimately. Back about as quickly as
he had taken it.
Took it. So this, I think, will dock Louis some points in both On Guard and Voulez-Vous, because I think how he treated the Italian subjects, who are his subjects, is, you know, a negative point for, you know, how he ruled. So while Louis may not have been the ideal conqueror, and we mustn't also forget that he did lose a civil war against Anne of France, a woman. mm-hmm. No, she had men on her side as well, but at home, he was the ideal peacetime ruler.
Yeah.
Or at least he appears to have been. So learning from the mistakes of the unpopular Louis XI and the clumsy Charles VIII, Louis created a PR machine for his regime that labeled him as the benevolent father of the people. and we talked about this in Enchanté, but this isn't all just smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
Louis was a very popular ruler among both his people and his nobles, and he's the first Valois king to have not dealt with any internal rebellions or civil wars.
Oh, wow, nice.
He also felt so secure with his internal peace that he actually unfortified his chateau at Blois. So he took down its walls. He made it into more of a villa than a fortress with sort of confidence. New gardens designed by Italian landscapers. So yeah, he's showing some confidence there, some security. So you can see Louis really sort of shaping his public image in a way that sort of legitimizes, empowers, and aggrandizes him in the eyes of the French people. And the fact that he spends so much time in Paris rather than disappearing off to his country chateau, I think really speaks volumes to how comfortable and secure he felt in his relationship to the population.
Yeah. Especially with the fickle Parisians.
Blois also is not a country chateau. It's an urban chateau. It's in a city. So again, he's like among his people. As I mentioned in his episode, he's the first king since Charles VI to die in Paris.
Yeah.
So Louis inherits a realm at peace. He keeps it at peace. The wars he fights are all across the Alps, focused elsewhere.
Not in...
With the brief exception of Henry VIII's invasion of Picardy in 1513, which we didn't really get into. But this was aided by the Habsburgs, who Henry is allied to through his wife, Catherine of Aragon, at this point. We'll see if that lasts. So Henry advanced from Calais to besiege Tournai. The Anglo-German force soundly defeated the French at the Battle of the Spurs, but they did run out of steam. Meanwhile, though, the King of Scots, Henry's brother-in-law, James IV, was defeated and killed in the north of England at the Battle of Flodden by an English army which was actually directed by Catherine of Aragon, who was the regent back in England. To make matters even worse, the Holy League's Swiss allies simultaneously tried to march into Burgundy, and they actually took the city of Dijon briefly.
Anytime you say Dijon, I just think of the mustard.
Yes, well, that is where the mustard comes from.
Yeah, I know.
But Louis XII, he's able to negotiate his way out of the defeat in part by marrying Mary Tudor. And within months of Louis's death, Francis I will win a big military victory, which actually wins the war for France. So France does win this war in the end. It's just
by Louis.
It's just after Louis dies. So the War of the Holy League, as it's called, the loss of Italy, the invasion of France, it's all a definite negative for Louis and En Garde, but ultimately France is no weaker than it was at the start of the
reign. People still scared of him.
Yeah, people still scared. But you could also argue that Louis's reorganization of his realm's finances, which we'll get into in Voulez-Vous, made it stronger as well. So he reorganizes the tax system and makes it more efficient, and also lowers taxes as well. And we'll get to that next round. So, but yeah, considering he's old and dying at the stage France is losing, I don't think we can blame him too much for the downturn in fortunes.
Yeah.
A lot of it sort of comes down to bad luck, like the deaths of some important allies, like Pope Alexander, the King of Scots, the Thunderbolt of Italy, the general that he had down in Italy. Yeah, they're sort of dropping like flies at this stage.
Mm.
So Louis the XII, he was maybe less sort of a workaholic, of detail oriented than Louis the XI was.
Yeah, but he was more love.
He was more into delegating power than Louis was. But yes, he was also more beloved. So Louis's most powerful advisor was Cardinal Georges d'Amboise,
mm-hmm.
whom some referred to as, quote, the true king of France.
Why?
Well, he was like a prime minister, sort of. And he really starts this trend of kings having powerful cardinals at their side who function as kind of this prime minister figure, and they're very important go-betweens with the church. And we'll see this reach its peak with the power of Cardinal Richelieu in the 1600s.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, Cardinal d'Amboise and Louis, they'd been friends from a young age. Amboise owes his rise to Louis. Because as Duke of Orleans, Louis had sort of helped him climb the ladder to become bishop, then archbishop, then cardinal. And having this extremely powerful churchman at his side, whose interests were completely aligned with his own, really sort of paid off for Louis once he became king. And sort of needed the support of the Borgias in Rome.
Yeah.
So, despite claims that Cardinal d'Amboise was kind of usurping the king's power, the two did work very closely. I doubt there was anything the cardinal doing that the king was not aware of and sort of consenting to. He's also quite similar to Cardinal Wolsey in England, who is also rising at this time. So the king, the cardinal, and a small group of other advisors would meet every single morning in the king's bedchamber as soon as he woke up. In what became known as the Conseil Secret, the Secret Council. And this will later evolve into the famous levée, the waking up, which is sort of an elaborate ritual the most powerful people in the kingdom sort of take turns dressing the king. That event, it eventually evolves into that. And by being present at this levée, the lords of France showing are able to sort of gain position. Access to the king, influence his first thoughts of the day, I guess. Despite people saying, oh, the cardinal's actually behind everything, Louis did show a lot of agency in his reign. He played an active role in shaping France in his image after a youth spent observing the flaws in the administration that came before. He's really learning the lessons of the past. And, he's just a very stable kind of ruler, but again, has his flaws.
Yeah.
So what do we think we want to give him for En Garde, the gaining and maintaining of power?
Well, he was good at gaining it. Maintaining it outside of France is a different question.
Yeah.
Because of that, since he did lose, he'll lose a few points, just not maintaining that, like, control of Milan. But, like, from France itself, that's kept it stable, so...
But the reason he loses Milan is because everyone else in Europe realizes that France is becoming way too powerful. So, like, he had to get to that stage of, like, becoming the top dog
in Europe. Then he wasn't able to maintain it.
He wasn't, no. But the fact that England, Spain, the Empire, the Pope all have to band together in order to defeat him.
Yeah.
I think speaks volumes of just how
powerful
he is.
Yeah.
This is also like France is the only country in Europe that has a standing army at this point.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Wow.
So he's got an extremely organized military. He's got this very advanced artillery as well. So he is very threatening.
I didn't realize he was the only one of standing army. The other countries are losers.
Well, this is part of why France has been able to just sort of steamroll its way through Italy every time. It's because their army is so well organized.
Yeah.
It's just a shame that their governors aren't as good. Just
good at controlling.
So they can't actually hold the lands,
Governors get greedy and corrupt.
Like Machiavelli said last episode, it was like, the Italians don't know how to fight, but the French don't know how to rule.
Yeah.
The French know how to rule France. They just don't know how to rule Italy.
Yeah.
And I guess that is definitely a negative for Louis.
Yeah. He didn't choose people correctly.
Yeah. I do think this would be a Middle East score, though.
Yeah. I'm thinking, like, a 6.
Yeah, I think a 6 is good.
Mm.
It's mainly the propaganda for me is the thing I like about Louis.
He did it very well.
But at the end of the day, he's not considered one of these great sort of powerful kings.
Yeah.
So you couldn't keep he was him. Great and powerful in his time, but...
But, yeah.
Outside of that, yeah. So that is a 12 on guard, 6 and a 6.
Okay.
And moving on to Voulez-Vous.
Voulez-Vous?
I think he's going to do better here.
Yes.
So because of the debt that his family was in when he was born, mm-hmm. Louis the 12th grew up frugally. He learned from an early age how to work within a budget. And he took this kind of penny-pinching tendency into his role as first the governor of Normandy, which he was at first. Then he was the governor of the Île-de-France and governor of Provence at one point as well. So he was basically, he was sent around to all these places. He had little
when
jobs.
When you're talking about frugal, it just makes you think of my dad. Because when we were little and we'd go traveling, since there was three kids, dad would sometimes just tell the people at the hotel he only had two children and one of us would have to sneak into the hotel.
It's a very Louis the 12th move.
I know.
So yeah, Louis was, as a result of being very conscious of money, he was always on the lookout for inefficiencies, corruptions, took money out of the royal treasury and sort of lined the pockets of uppity nobles. And at the same time, he wasn't above a little corruption himself. He would often sell officers in his administration in order to earn a quick buck.
I'll blame him for that.
He also upheld the pragmatic sanction of Bourges, which we've discussed before. It's basically Charles VII started this. It's basically like protecting the rights and liberties of the French Church at the expense of the Pope. And this, the idea of this is to stop the Pope from siphoning too much money out of the French economy. And Louis defended this policy to the point of almost being excommunicated by Pope Julius. Yeah.
Oh, I knew it wasn't going to be Pope Alexander.
No, this is Julius. This is the one, the warrior Pope who turns against him. But Louis wasn't stingy the way that Louis the 11th was stingy. Louis the 11th had been a hoarder of wealth. Which he'd obtained from his nobles and citizens through harsh taxes, as penalties for infractions, or through straight-up murder and robbery.
Yeah.
Louis the 12th was a little bit more of an altruist. He very rarely prosecuted people the way that his predecessors had. One exception is the Marshal Gier, who's the guy who let spill the beans about the secret betrothal between his daughter and Francis. He let Anne of Brittany know. He announced it basically to the court when Louis was ill and people thought Louis would die. And Marshal Gier comes along and is like,
"It's okay.
Just so you all know, his daughter's supposed to marry the next king of France." And everyone's like, "What?
What?
I thought she was meant to marry a Habsburg." And it was this whole drama. We talked about it in Anne of Brittany's part two. But this leads to Gier being like banished and accused of lèse majesté and all this stuff. But that's the only instance where that really happens.
You've damaged my marriage. shall be punished.
But I think when you compare it to past and future reigns, all the different people who end up getting screwed over, like purges that happen. It's extremely stable in Louis's reign. People hold offices for life. When they die, they get replaced, basically, for the most part. So Louis is bringing in this new generation of people who he kind of grew up with. He's got this circle of very loyal nobles around him who are loyal to him when he's the Duke of Orléans. So he does bring those people in, but he doesn't chuck out the old people either.
Yeah.
He wants to be true to his title of Father of the People. Some of his nobles mock him for his humble lifestyle. They call him the commoner king. And they also criticized him for withholding their pensions. They weren't getting subsidized as much from the crown as they used to. To which Louis responded, quote, "I much prefer to make the dandies laugh at my miserliness than make the people weep at my open-handedness."
Yeah, true, that's good. Oh, I thought you meant pensions. I was thinking old people, but I realized you meant pensions. Like, you know how they always got that.
No. Yeah. Pensions.
I know, different meaning. Yeah, I remembered.
Today we say pensions to mean money that's given to old people. Back then, money was given to already rich people.
Yeah.
So yeah, Louis's basically saying, you know, I'd rather the rich people hate me for being stingy than the poor people hate me from spending too much.
Yeah. And dying.
Yeah.
From starvation.
Yeah. And getting guillotined. Well, he didn't know about that.
Yeah, that was invented,
so, but maybe he saw ahead. He had a vision.
Could have been done by axe or sword.
Yeah. So this is the thing we've seen before, like the king getting in the good graces of the common folk and kind of using that against the nobility. And Louis does it quite well.
Nice.
So Louis kind of reformed things, particularly the tax system, and he brought prosperity to the country that enabled it to flourish under the reign of Francis I, the great Renaissance king. Basically, Louis walks so that Francis can run. And one big change is, of course, the lowering of the extortionate taxes. In fact, Louis is said to have wept whenever he had to impose a tax.
I wish people in power these days would do that.
Yeah, well, this is, once again, propaganda, but, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe he did it. And when taxes do eventually rise again in the 16th century, people kind of looked back to the old days of Louis with fondness. They're like, remember?
Well, like how we do. Yeah. We're like, when our parents like how we grew do, up.
Yeah. Yeah, we're like, oh, they got free education.
What do we get? Yeah. Crippling debt.
In fact, actually later on, speaking of the guillotine, in the 18th century, like during the early French Revolution, when it looks like France would end up having a constitutional monarchy, the French reformers actually saw Louis as a model for a constitutional monarch. So a king who rules by consensus. Mm. Yeah. Because Louis's always having councils approve his decisions. He's got people like the cardinal advising him.
Yeah.
And he's always trying to do...
He talks to the people.
He talks to the people, yeah. He also brings back my ideas only. Yeah. He also brings back the touching for the king's evil as well. The scrofula. Where he goes and touches people and they apparently get cured.
Yeah.
And that is part of, you know, walking among interacting with everyday people. Yeah.
Yeah, get that propaganda.
Which is something that Louis the 11th did, but maybe for more nefarious purposes.
God, I feel so people were under Louis the 11th, they would have been afraid if they got touched by the king, they'd be poisoned.
Yeah. A couple of negatives for popularity were Louis' scandal at the start of his reign with his divorce of Joan, is marrying Anne. But once he married Anne, they were an absolute power couple in terms of their public image and how the people basically adored them. And then, just as we get a smooth transition of power at the start of his reign, we also get that at the end of his reign. By marrying Claude to Francis I, you know, this is something that maybe Anne of Brittany didn't like, but which was ultimately very good for the stability of France because it meant that the king's daughter became the new queen.
Yeah.
And there was a kind of a continuity there.
Yeah.
Even though the crown was going to a second cousin. It's all right. And in terms of personal character, Louis was more of an athlete than a scholar. But he shared with his wife, Anne of Brittany, a love of culture and pageantry. He particularly loved music as well. Apparently he loved singing along with the choir in his chapel, but he was a terrible singer. So like he couldn't hit the notes. So his composers started writing a special part to their music called the Vox Regis, which was simpler and easier to sing.
Aww.
So the king could sing along.
Oh, that really is so cute.
It is very endearing, actually.
That is.
I find that more endearing than the propaganda.
Oh, yeah, that is so endearing.
Louis XII was always very inspired by ancient Rome. You know, he's one of those men who thinks about the Roman Empire every day. And he kind of applies this to the reforms in his kingdom. In particular, the notion of the king being the first citizen of the kingdom, or the first among princes. So while he believed that the king's power should be absolute, as he was appointed by God, so his word was the law, he also believed that a good king submitted himself to the laws and precedents that came before him.
Yeah, he's
and this is part of his sort of ruling with councils, ruling by consensus kind of thing.
Nice.
He's very sort of orthodox and traditional when it came to like government and religion. He's not, you know, reinventing the wheel, but he's maybe just sort of more effective, I guess, in using these tools that he's inherited.
Yeah.
When it came to culture, though, and like cultural progression, Louis was quite progressive. So he's bringing in all these Italian artists. He's supporting the printing press, but not just as a propaganda tool. He did put regulations on like who could run printing presses and how much they could print. But aside from that, he gave the print workers a lot of freedom. And he actually decreed that import taxes should not be placed on books.
Nice.
So this allowed sort of knowledge and ideas to spread more freely. However, Louis personally preferred the good old-fashioned illuminated manuscripts for his own sort of collections. Yeah. But he was like amazed by printing. He called it more divine than human as a method of communication. He thought it was amazing.
Oh, can you imagine him if he had seen like a computer or a phone?
Oh yeah.
That'd have been too much for his poor heart to handle.
Yeah, his nose would start bleeding. His...
He would have fainted from joy.
So Louis, he believed in a sort of semi-freedom of speech. He allowed and even sometimes sponsored theatre troupes performing comedies that criticised his own government.
Oh, wow.
According to his courtier, Jean Boucher, this is because he saw it as a good way of seeing the common man's perspective of his ministers and their flaws. Yeah.
Smart.
So this is another way of him kind of learning about the people and their sort of what's up with them, basically.
And also finding out maybe things he didn't know about his officials.
Yeah, exactly. And you've also got the rise of humanist philosophy happening in France as well, which starts to become a big thing at the University of Paris.
Nice.
So Louis is, I would say, almost on par with Anne of Brittany in terms of cultural path. He's also, this is probably like a discussion we could probably have a bit more in depth in a future aim when it becomes like a bit more relevant, but there are also changes happening to the French nobility in which more of the administrative courtiers are starting to get noble titles as opposed to just the sort of warrior class.
Oh, nice.
Being the nobility. So these are called the noblesse de robe, the nobles of the robe, as opposed to the noblesse d'épée, the nobles of the sword. So there's a kind of new sort of bourgeois class kind of coming into nobility.
I would have preferred if it was nobles of the pen and nobles of the sword.
Yeah, but you know, it's at least progress.
Yeah.
It's basically like if you had enough money, you could buy yourself a chateau, buy yourself a coat of arms. Get a little charter from the king saying you're noble now.
Nice.
And this shows to an extent that there was some social mobility, even if it's at the very top of society. But yeah, overall, Louis the 12th strikes me as a very sensible king. He's not changing too much too fast. He's not destabilizing the realm. He's approaching things diplomatically.
Yeah.
And you know, when he does have to show a firm hand, he's not vindictive or vengeful. He doesn't take things too far. The main thing I criticize him for here is the conduct of his soldiers in Italy, which he does not really do anything to.
Yeah, he doesn't stop
Stop. There is the bit with Genoa where he enters peacefully and it's this big display of like,
oh yeah,
I am a peaceful conqueror, you know, but that was paving over a lot of atrocities that were meanwhile happening in Lombardy. Yeah. So, again, it's PR.
Yeah, sweeping it under the carpet, so to speak.
Exactly. But you could equally argue, you know, Milan's not really... We don't care about that. No, that was mean. But within France, things are improving.
Yeah.
Also, like, diplomacy-wise, Louis is, despite being, like... despite everyone eventually sort of turning against him, he is
your
this
enemy
sort of,
number one.
Yeah, he is this very good. He's a very skilled diplomat. He's good at bringing people together.
Yeah, he got like the Borgias.
He brought people together. Yeah, and he also originally brought everyone together against Venice, and that was considered like a masterstroke of diplomacy. And he had, you know, despite his eventual wars that he has with the Habsburgs, he is on quite good terms with the Habsburgs.
Yeah,
throughout his reign, compared to
future rulers, at least. So yeah, so there are negatives, but I always come back around to kind of a positive view of Louis at the end of the day.
Yeah, like generally, yeah, I'd like want to live under him, I feel like, if I was in France, not Italy, but I'm thinking like maybe like a 7.5 or an 8.
Mm.
I think I just need like some giant sweeping like thing, like reform.
Yeah.
To make it higher.
Yeah, I think 8 is good, which is the same score as Anne of Brittany. Ah, I got an 8 from each of us.
Yeah.
Well, so I think 8. That's kind of fitting.
Yeah.
They're a power couple. So
score together, married together.
Apart from the 5 years of separation. So that is a 16 overall for Voulez-Vous. Now moving on to Ooh La La.
Yes.
We've got some juicy stuff here.
Ooh La La.
So most of the fuss and scandal in Louis' early life stems from his evil cousin slash father-in-law slash godfather, Louis the 11th, the Universal Spider. Because he's forced, the Universal Spider forces him into a marriage with a daughter who repulses him. And because he is given very little allowance by the king as well, his pension is cut. He seeks comfort in the arms of cheap sex workers.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have enough money to keep a classy mistress, which was the expected thing at the time. It's what any self-respecting prince would do, is keep a mistress if you didn't like your wife. But Louis does not. Louis does clean up his act once he marries Anne of Brittany, with whom he seems to be genuinely in love. But this marriage is in itself a scandal, given the divorce proceedings that came before it. So he's
marrying his cousin's wife.
Yeah. So in spite of his callous treatment of Joan, especially during the divorce proceedings, Louis the 12th kept her in a state of comfort. He never touched her dowry as well.
Good.
So, you know, he never used her dowry on the grounds that he didn't believe that they were married.
Yeah.
He also compensated her with a generous income by making her the Duchess of Berry.
Oh, yeah.
Which is honestly pretty generous. It's unprecedented for a French princess to be made a duchess in her own right.
Yeah.
It's
the least he could do.
Ironically, she gets the Castle of Bourges as part of this, which is where Louis had been imprisoned.
Well, I don't think he'd want that castle.
This probably doesn't make up for the years of misery that, that Joan suffered.
Yeah.
Particularly the divorce itself is very nasty.
Yeah.
Towards her, but Joan does end up living a good life in the end. She withdraws from political life. She'd been humiliated enough by men. She had all this wealth from her appanage, so she actually ended up taking the vows of a nun and using her wealth to found a new order. Cool. So this order is a branch of the Poor Clares. Called the Order of the Annunciation of the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Of course.
That's a bit of a mouthful. So they're called the Annunciades for short.
Nice.
Which still exists today. It's an extremely small order of about 80 nuns across 8 monasteries in Europe.
Cute.
So shout out to the Annunciades.
Woo! My school had nuns.
Oh yeah, your school did have nuns.
Yeah, we have a convent next to it.
Yeah.
Sometimes you'd see the nuns going to the archives.
Yeah, my school had Jesuit priests. Joan, despite an early death at the age of 38, she did have this lasting legacy through this patronage, and she ended up being beatified in the 18th century and then made a saint by
Pope Francis in
1950.
Good on her. So she's Saint Joan. Claps.
Yeah. So despite his faithfulness to his second wife, Anne of Brittany, Louis's time with Anne, it is a real soap opera because of their lack of sons, the marriage of their daughters, Claude and Renee, a big hot button issue, constant headache. As Anne is determined to get one or both married to Habsburgs, essentially to just thwart Louis's long-term plan of uniting France and Brittany together in a sort of personal union. But, you know, Louis ends up overcoming this, ends up getting Claude married to Francis, his successor. But there's a lot of drama along the way, which we explored more in Anne of Brittany's episode. Anne does then try to disinherit Claude and make Renee the Duchess. intending to marry her to a Habsburg once again. We'll get into who Habsburgs. Renee marries. Yeah. We'll get into who Renee marries in Living on Throne. She's just a child when Louis dies, though.
Yeah.
But the contradictory wishes of Claude Renee's parents creates conflict between the two sisters and their descendants as well. Huh. So this creates lasting ulalas through the generation as well. So the final scandal in Louis XII's life surrounds his third marriage to Mary Tudor.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm sure there would be listeners who came into this podcast knowing just one thing about Louis XII, and that he married Henry VIII's sister and he died from overexerting himself in the bedchamber. Like, that's what he's kind of most famous for in England. But as we covered last episode, this has been exaggerated. He was suffering severely from gout already when the marriage was made, which is almost certainly what killed him. But the gossip mongers of the time had a lot of fun with this brief marriage. One singer claimed that England had rented France a spry young filly to carry the king off to paradise.
Oh.
Yeah.
I have to nod my head to that.
So, side note, Mary Tudor came to France with a huge dowry and a huge entourage, which included 13-year-old Anne Boleyn, who was the daughter of the ambassador to France. Yeah. So she was there. So if you know, this marriage had lasted a bit longer, Anne Boleyn may not have gone back to England and done what she did. So the real scandal, the real scandal, though, occurs after Louis is dead. When Henry VIII, when Henry VIII had sent Mary to France, she was already in love with one of his boyhood companions, Sir Charles Brandon. Knowing that Louis XII was old, probably wouldn't last very long, Mary made Henry promise that when the king died, she could marry whoever she wanted.
Smart.
Yes, this was their cunning plan. So Henry had no intention of keeping this promise, but Mary was his favorite sister, so he was very indulgent towards her. So he's like, all right, whatever you want, blah, 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 blah. Go to France, marry the king. Mm-hmm. So Mary goes to France, marries the king. He dies 12 weeks later.
Damn.
And then Mary returns to England and marries Charles Brandon before Henry can do anything about it, basically. Damn. They're secretly married.
Yeah.
Henry does end up coming round, confirming the marriage. Charles Brandon ends up getting a cushy dukedom.
Probably wasn't too happy though.
And they end up being the ancestors of Jane Grey, the infamous 9 days queen. So despite being only married to the king for 12 weeks, Mary did style herself as Queen of France the rest of her life. She was entitled to the income and privileges of a queen dowager. So, like, basically France had to send her money for the rest of her life.
God.
And this included the right to retain any of the jewels, including some valuable Valois heirlooms that Louis XII had given her. So as you can imagine, this really peeved off Francis I, who tried to stop Mary from returning to England for a while. So the excuse was that she might be pregnant with the king's child, so she needs to stay. Also mourning as well. But Mary got out basically as soon as she could, and she took all the jewels.
Oh, I'd be so peeved.
But, like, I'd do that as well.
Yeah.
I don't blame her.
But that would be, like coming from, like, France's point of view. It'd be like if my brother had a wife and his wife took my sister-in-law took all the jewels that my mother had, like all my mum's jewelry. I would be like, oh!
Maybe that's payback for Francis giving Louis XII the crappy funeral.
Yeah, true, true. From
last episode. He was really stingy with Louis XII's funeral.
Yeah.
And then I guess he loses money anyway because
come on.
Mary takes off with the jewel. And the dispute between the jewels was just one of many disputes that Francis and Henry VIII are going to have.
Of course.
So aside from marriage drama and the sauciness, as well as the continuation of the atrocities in Italy that we saw in with Charles VIII, Louis XII was generally regarded as a pretty honorable, upstanding, chivalrous kind of king. So I would hesitate about giving him too high of an ulala score. Well, especially since a lot of the scandal in his life is driven by other people.
Yeah, but then he wasn't, for Joan at least, he didn't make it an easy off.
No, but I mean, it wasn't like a Catherine of Aragon situation where she was just like cast out into the cold, basically.
Yeah, I know. Like,
she was, you know, despite it being like an ugly lawsuit, Lou was kind of doing what he had to do. And at the end of the day, he did keep her in a comfortable lifestyle.
Yeah.
Didn't touch her dowry. Like, he was doing all of the sort of quote-unquote honorable things.
Yeah.
Like, sure, it might have been heartbreaking for her on a personal level.
Yeah.
But in terms of her, you know, physical well-being.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I'll give...
She was okay.
I'm going to give a point for the divorce because, you know, not very often you see the kings getting divorced.
I think it might be worth 2 points.
Yeah, I was thinking point and a half. I'll do point and a half. I'm going to give another point for Anne just being like, I'm not going to talk to you for like 5 years and go all the way back home away from you. Like, I'm not even going to stay in the same city as you. I'm going to like go away. I'm so peeved at you. And then I'm going to get a point for like the scandaliciousness surrounding his death, just because like, obviously we know it was like gout, but just because of all the like fun that came from that, of like the rumors and the goss. So that's a 3.5.
Yeah, I think I'll give him a 3.5 as well. So that gives him a 7, which is the same score as Anne of France, actually.
Okay.
His great rival. Anne of France, by the way, is still alive.
Nice.
She outlives Louis the 12th by about 20 years.
Oh.
Yes, she's still kicking around. She actually has a major dispute with Francis the First, which we'll get into in Francis' episode. Nice. Basically, Francis tries to grab her land.
And she's like, no.
No. Yeah.
I she am your elder and you will respect me.
You will respect me. Mm-hmm. So that is a 7-foot la la. And moving on to the Unthrone.
The Vion Throne.
Louis reigned from the 7th of April, 1498, when Charles VIII died by a lintel, until the 1st of January, 1515, when he himself died of either gout or sex. So that's 16 years, 8 months, and 25 days on the throne. Not the longest reign. Yeah. It's only 3.1 points towards his Vion Throne score. But not the shortest. He reigned only 2 years more than Charles VIII did. Although he wasn't a child for any of it. So really it comes out as seeming like a much longer reign.
Yeah, really does.
He definitely accomplished a lot more than Charles did. And So Louis the 12th, moving on to the children, he only has children by his second wife, Anne of Brittany, of course.
Yeah.
So with Mary Tudor, he doesn't have the time or energy. And with Joan of France, he had plenty of time, but not the willingness.
So
Anne brought up to 3 sons to term that we know of. But all were either stillborn or died very quickly after birth.
Aww.
Their only 2 surviving children were their daughters, Claude and Renee. I find it interesting that both girls were given unisex names. Because Claude and Renee in France are names that you can give to girls or boys.
I guess maybe they chose the name before they had the babe.
Maybe. So. And fairly original names for the French royal family.
Yeah,
as well.
We haven't heard
so
that.
So Claude is the French form of Claudia, which is a Roman imperial name. Maybe Anne named her that because she wanted her to be the Holy Roman Empress. By marrying her to Hapsburg. And then Renee, the name Renee means rebirth. It was a reference to the miracle of Christ's resurrection. But also we speculate maybe the rebirth of Anne and Louis' marriage after their separation, which is when Renee was born. She was potentially named after Renee of Anjou as well. Who was a claimant to the throne, to the kingdom of Naples. So this may be a reference to the Naples claim. So Claude married Frances, the future Frances I, a few weeks after her mother's death. So Louis waited until Anne was dead before doing that marriage. So Claude simultaneously became the Duchess of Brittany and the future Queen of France in one fell swoop.
Wow.
Renee's destiny, meanwhile, lay in Italy.
Oh.
So while Claude was a teenager, Renee was only 4 years old when her father died. But when she was 18, Francis married her off to Ercole d'Este, the Duke of Ferrara.
Oh.
Ferrara's a big ally of France in Italy. And Ercole was not only the nephew of Beatrice d'Este, but he was also the son of Lucrezia Borgia.
Ah.
Yeah, or one of her sons.
Connections.
And Renee, throughout her life, continued to dispute her sister's claim on Brittany. So from Italy, she's causing a bit of noise. And she also continued this rebellious strain by becoming a supporter later in her life of the heretical Swiss preacher, John Calvin.
Oh.
So this makes Renee of France the only member of the House of Valois to have been a Protestant.
Oh, damn.
Which is really interesting. I had to avoid going down a whole rabbit hole. She was the black sheep. I had to avoid going down a whole rabbit hole into Renee's life. It might be a good Patreon episode, actually.
Yeah, I was about to say. Sounds interesting.
But she lives all the way up to 1575.
So it'll be a while before we could do a special on her.
Yeah, maybe. So that's two children, gives Louis the 12th, like his wife, and 3.38 points. Mm-hmm. So that's a total, if we add up the reign and the children, it's a total V on thread score of 6.5.
Okay.
Which is Now it is time for the final score.
Da-da-da-ling.
55.5.
Yes.
So 5.55. That is a comparable score to. It's slightly lower than Charles V. It's way lower than Anne of Brittany. A lot of Louis XII's reign feels like kind of just like set up to Francis I's reign in most of the things that I've read. Not a lot of biographies are written about Louis XII. He's not got those climactic highs that we're going to see Francis has. He has struggled over the centuries to stand out in his own right.
Yeah.
And he's never seen as like one of the greatest rulers of all time. But that being said, in his defense, counterpoint, part of the purpose of this podcast, I think, is to
find the hidden gems.
Find the hidden gems and tell the complete story. And I think Louis may think be one of those gems.
Yeah, he should be more well-known.
I'm not betting money on him winning the Battle Royale tournament.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I think he could survive a round or two.
You're really hedging on
it. We've definitely spared worse people than Louis the 12th. But then again, we've beheaded better people.
True.
It's really all over the place at this point. With
I don't know. Like, he's good and he's like a pleasant surprise, but I don't know. I feel as though he's like missing something. But at the same time, I'm like, oh, like I do agree with you. I don't think he would make it very many rounds.
But is that? But I don't know if that's part of our criteria. Is how far he would make it? I think.
Oh yeah, I never think about that. I do personally like him.
It's not would he win, it's is he deserving of competing?
Yeah. Does he deserve to live or die? Da-da-da-da. What are you going with?
I'm like, I think I'm like just leaning into sparing him.
I think I am as well.
Narrowly. Narrowly.
Yeah.
To the extent that I'm like considering a coin toss. If you are also narrowly agreeing.
It's like 1% over.
Yeah. It's like Brexit.
Yeah, basically.
Okay. Yeah, no, let's spare him.
Okay. I feel as though we've forgotten to do the question you always ask, who's the most fabulous
blah, blah, blah. Oh, right, yeah. So, Eliza, You can answer yes or no after this. Is he fascinating enough, entertaining enough, majestic and fabulous and irresistible enough to be released from our dungeon, to go through to the Battle Royale Championship, and to be spared the guillotine?
Well, by the... what's it? The hairs of whiskers. What's that thing about the nick of the something?
Of your chinny chin chin.
No. You know...
He's a hair's breadth away
yes,
from...
Yes, that's it. Death.
The guillotine.
But ultimately it's a hair's breadth away, so he is through.
We've taken him up to the scaffold. We've put his head in the thing.
We like Catherine Howard of practicing the guillotine.
Yeah. But at the last minute, we've jerked him away just as the thing falls.
Yeah.
And he is spared, and he is going through to the tournament.
Yes. So let us know if you agree with us or not.
Yeah.
What do you guys think of him?
I feel like this may be a controversial decision.
Yeah, this was. I don't know. I guess it's just... yeah, I don't know.
But he's good. He's like a good king. He's good at his job.
Yeah.
And like, I think we should...
He's not as well known just because he's surrounded by a lot of other people who in history who are well known. So he just slips through the cracks, which he doesn't... I think it's a bit unfair to him.
It is a bit unfair to him. And I think we need to praise rulers in history more who are sensible and don't go off the rails. And maybe that means that they cause less of a splash. But also maybe that means that you can feed your family.
Yeah. Good, considering I feel as though we need some more leaders like that these days.
Exactly. So are you saying Louis XII is like the Joe Biden of... of Renaissance France?
Well, he's not the Trump, maybe. That's for sure.
So that is Louis XII. Next week on Patreon, we're going to have Caterina Sforza, which is very exciting. The week after that, we're going to do a Regency episode on Louise of Savoy.
Oh.
Because Francis I is very young when he comes to the throne, actually.
Oh.
So she's not really like full regent.
She's like semi-regent.
Because Francis is, well, he's a teenager. So he's like kind of in control, but kind of not really. And he also immediately goes on campaign the first thing in his reign. So she's effectively the regent. And she also becomes regent later on as well. So Louise of Savoy, she's very important. She's also very important for learning more about the early life of Francis, which means we'll have to cover less in his episode. So that's useful as well. So we're doing Louise next.
Is that his mother?
And after Louise, that's his mother, yes.
Yeah, thought so.
Yeah. And after Louise, we'll finally get into Francis himself. And in the boudoir on Patreon, we'll be resuming our series on the royal mistresses.
Woo!
As well, which is very exciting. We'll be learning about the two great loves of Francis' life.
And I really feel like you can't say someone's a great love when they've had multiple.
They overlap. It's quite dramatic.
Exactly. You can't have two great loves at once.
I disagree. I think love is boundless, Eliza. Love is limitless. Yeah.
But not at the expense of others. I'm betting those two fought. Okay, I bet you. As long as everyone gets along, I don't care how many people you love, but when you're causing fighting and all that jazz, then no, that is not your great love.
And also if it goes both ways.
Yes.
Like there's no equality in the situation. Like women aren't allowed to have multiple lovers.
I agree.
Yeah. So that's what we're doing next. We do have a message about, you know, how we say like don't go on horses.
Yeah.
We had a message from someone on WordPress. Who says, this is by Lioness Feather.
Yeah.
And they say, you guys keep being astonished at horse-related deaths and asking why people are even getting onto horses. But they are the primary means of transport for people who travel a lot. Of course, yes, there are going to be many horse-related deaths.
We know
just look
that
at modern-day car crash statistics for an analogy, and yet we aren't surprised when someone dies in a car crash. Otherwise, really enjoy the podcast. They say.
Well, I know but it's more just like it's not that they're using the horse as a mode of transport when they die. They're using the horse like recreational, like hunting or bloody going home.
That would be the point I'd make. Like, whenever there's a horse-related death, it's always something dumb.
Yeah, it's not like they were trying to, like, get home.
They're not really getting from A to B. There are some horse-related deaths where they are traveling.
Yeah.
But it's always... there's always extenuating circumstances. Like, they were going too fast. Like, yeah, it was raining. It was, like, storming.
Something in the way. They fell off the horse. But I'm like, so far, deaths have definitely been like...
Which I guess, I guess you could say that for modern car crashes as well. But I'm not going to be like, well, it was... I think at a certain extent, you do also have to blame the dead person.
If you hadn't gone hunting, you might have lived.
But yes, when we say don't go on horses, that is a joke. We support horse riding.
If the horses like it.
But if you're a king, don't go on horses.
Yeah, that's the main premise. Not that I think we've many kings listening. If we did, hello.
Yeah, and don't joust if you're a king. Yeah. And
careful of lintels.
Careful of lintels. Don't chase maidens on horses and end up getting your head hit on lintels. I'm looking at you, Louis III.
Don't get too vigorous in the bed that you end up dying.
Don't get too vigorous in the bedchamber. It's becoming a very prudish podcast.
Well, come on. I guess some people would want to go that way.
You can't have multiple loves. You must be with one person.
And well, you can have multiple loves. Passionate
in the bedchamber.
You just can't be a dick when it comes. Yeah.
Just
treat people well. Don't be a shitty lover. And preferably don't die while you're doing it, because that would haunt people.
And that's going to be au revoir from me.
Goodbye from me.